B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Thursday, March 26, 2020. In news you will find almost nowhere else in U.S. corporate media, there's been a big victory for the water protectors who protested near the end of the Obama administration in Standing Rock, North Dakota. And I want to give a shout out to the Standing Rock Sioux and to many Americans from the West Coast, from the central part of the nation, all over the U.S., who rose to the occasion and went to Standing Rock in the middle of a brutal winter where they endured water cannons, private detectives and mercenaries who were dispatched there, undercover agents, including one who slept with a Native American woman and set her up to go to prison because she had his gun. Well, it was an ugly episode, but the Standing Rock Sioux Nation stood strong and firm. And then they went and got lawyered up. And the future of the Dakota Access Pipeline has been thrown into question. A federal court yesterday struck down its permits and ordered a comprehensive environmental review. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers was ordered to conduct a full environmental impact statement after the Washington, D.C. court ruled that existing permits violated the National Environmental Policy Act. Now, there's a little more here, but I want to note that I did an online search. And the report that I found was from a British newspaper, The Guardian. And I do survey their website every day. I find their coverage in the United States is often better, and they break stories that the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other major newspapers don't bother with. And I want to mention that ABC Television News did have a story on this yesterday. I don't know what broadcast it appeared on. But other than ABC, even the New York Times that tells you you can get all the news that's fit to print, well, it didn't fit. So Mike Faith, the tribal chairman, said after years of commitment to defending our water and earth, we welcome this news of a significant legal win. It's humbling to see how actions we took to defend our ancestral homeland continue to inspire national conversations about how our choices ultimately affect this planet. And this was one of the dark eras of the Obama administration. And Barack himself took a kind of hands-off position after he had waited for everybody else to take a position on the Keystone XL pipeline. And he not only remained quiet, but he was silent as the forces of repression that I cited a moment ago were rolled into action. Then Trump took office in his first week in a flourish with one of those executive orders that he signs in huge signature with a Sharpie. He issued that order to expedite construction, which was completed in June of 2017. So the tribe challenged the permits. They've won. The Corps of Engineers ordered to redo its environmental analysis, which the court said it did without taking into consideration tribal concerns or expert analysis. The pipeline has continued to transfer oil from North Dakota to Illinois. And let's salute the lawyers here. Earth Justice, which is the legal arm of the Sierra Club, handled the case, and they deserve credit for a major victory. Meanwhile, I want to correct an item yesterday. And first, let me mention that after I finished recording the podcast, I was horrified to see that I had talked for an hour and 8 minutes. That's longer than I ever expect your attention span or your devotion to PBC, and I'm going to try to limit it a little bit. Originally, this is supposed to be a half-hour daily podcast, and it has crept longer and longer because there is so much news to report. And I've gotten some, you know, compliments from people who like the extended report, but I'm aware of your time limits. So Let me know if you actually listened to the entire podcast yesterday, all right? Send an email to Peter at peterbcollins.com. And one of the things that I aired on yesterday was that I was under the impression that the Senate had passed the bill. The $2 trillion bailout, which is actually worth more than $6 trillion when you look at the multiplier effect of the money that has been promised to the Federal Reserve. But what delayed things yesterday was a last-ditch effort by Lindsey Graham, two Republican senators named Scott, Timmy and Ricky, and Ben Sasse of Nebraska. And the only thing they objected to in this huge debt-based handout to corporate America is that the federal addition to unemployment benefits at $600 a week could add up to more than many people's regular salaries. And Lindsey Graham is worried that that would lead you to just quit your job and take a ride on unemployment. You're literally incentivizing taking people out of the workforce, he said. And despite being corrected by his own colleague, Republican Finance Committee Chair Chuck Grassley, he said, look, the bill already contains incentives for businesses to keep employees on the payroll, and nobody who leaves a job voluntarily is eligible to receive unemployment. He rejected the caps as unfeasible. And we also have to credit Bernie Sanders because he stood up for working Americans. And he basically threatened to hold up the processing of this bill and the expedited effort by Mitch McConnell to get this cash into the hands of corporate America with some crumbs for the rest of us. And I've just done a kind of back-of-the-envelope analysis because there's still so much that we don't know about what's tucked into this bill. Both Republicans and Democrats are likely guilty of putting in bits of funding or legislation that they have long wanted to get passed, and they see this as the only way by attaching it to a must-pass bill. It's ugly, it's odious, and it's Washington business as usual. So Bernie said that he would launch his own campaign to hold up the bill, and the Republicans did back down. And just a quick side note, because I don't plan to have any other stories today about the presidential campaign of the Democrats. This is a deeply error-ridden report by the Associated Press that showed up in my morning paper here, the San Francisco Chronicle. It opens, "There is no 12th presidential Democratic debate on the horizon now that the nominating process is in a holding pattern due to the coronavirus pandemic." One of the DNC's lead debate organizers, and pardon me if I mispronounce the name here, Xochitl Hinojosa, said the party has not set a date or secured a television partner for what would have been or would be the final encounter of the 12 debates that DNC Chairman Tom Perez promised at the campaign's outset. Now, he hasn't kept most of his promises. He changed the rules 3 times. The second time was to include Mike Bloomberg, who fortunately fizzled out like a bottle rocket. The third was to exclude Tulsi Gabbard. And the first was the mechanics of shifting the eligibility requirements that were confusing and that aggravated a lot of people. So here's what really irks me. There's no evidence that either Joe Biden, the prospective nominee, or Bernie Sanders, Biden's last remaining rival, is clamoring for a debate. And there's doubt among the candidates' advisors that one will occur. Now, this is bullshit, because Bernie has publicly stated that he wants a debate, he is prepared to debate in April, and he is expecting to do so. And the Biden campaign, trying to capitalize on the delegate lead that Joe enjoys at this point, and trying to prevent any further gaffes or problematic garbled speech or even downright lies. And so I just find that really appalling yellow journalism. Now to some of the details, and I can't cover this entire huge bill, and we don't know everything that's in it. But Nancy Pelosi said, and I saw her interviewed on the PBS NewsHour last night, that she expects her House on Friday will pass this bill, and they're hoping that there will be no objections, and they can do it on a voice vote. Now, there is rumor that Justin Amash, a former Republican, now an independent House member from Michigan, he may oppose this because of the impact on the long-term debt of the United States. And there are concerns about that. And I think that Justin Amash should at least offer an amendment to repeal the 2017 tax cuts. And I think people like Ro Khanna or other progressive people should at least verbalize support for a tax on the wealthy. Because when all this shakes out, if the bailouts, the stimulus, the handouts are successful in reducing the length and depth of a recession, I think it's inevitable that we're going into a recession, then we should be talking about getting the wealthy to pay for this. Because as the stock market recovers, they've got the cash to buy low and ride it back up. And I believe that since we're giving companies that have failed for other reasons than the coronavirus, or that at least have serious pre-existing conditions, that it's only fair. I also believe that, and we'll get to a critical look at the package here in a moment, but that the needs of corporate America really are not that great. It's average people who are suffering. And the Democrats did win some significant concessions. But, for example, the direct payments to Americans are limited to $1,200, and it's one time. And here in California, we're expecting the shelter-in-home order to remain in effect for up to 2 months, if not longer. And so Pelosi has acknowledged that she's going to be coming back and asking for more money. But I think that they had to make difficult trade-offs because they were handed a Republican bill that they had not seen that was just so biased toward the banksters, the corporate greedsters, and crumbs. Maybe one loaf of bread for regular Americans. So the other change in the payouts to Americans is that they removed the regressive nature of it. And so people under $75,000 all the way to the bottom will get the $1,200 payment. And over $75,000, it will be phased lower and lower up to incomes of $99,000. Plus, there is an additional $500 per child payment that will be included. Now, we don't know exactly when this money will be doled out, but if the House approves it, as Pelosi hopes tomorrow, it appears that the Treasury can just crank up the money machine and get those checks in the mail. There are other issues about people who don't have bank accounts. The check cashing centers aren't open. and those are issues that I think haven't been fully thought through. Now, in addition, this wrangling over the $600 a week federal addition to unemployment benefits, the Democrats won the concessions that include not only independent contractors like Uber drivers and gig musicians, but also part-time workers. And interestingly, while they can't calculate what each state will offer in unemployment benefits to part-timers, the $600 a week addition will apply to them. So, yes, the Democrats won some improvements. And it comes really in time because I think I mentioned last week that the Trump administration ordered state unemployment offices not to release their figures state by state. He wanted a coordinated response. Well, it leads to a really big number. More than 3 million people have filed for unemployment benefits in the past week, and it appears to be the highest ever demand for these unemployment benefits. Just 3 weeks ago, only 200,000 people applied for jobless benefits in a particular week. So when you add all this up, this package alone authorizes debt-based spending by the federal government of over $6 trillion. And when I do this calculation, it's about 6-1, corporate over people. And that is the ugly reality of Washington in a government dominated by Republicans. The final text is still not released. But the way this works is that the amount of money that is authorized to be distributed by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin and the Federal Reserve is described as $500 billion, but $425 billion of that can be leveraged 10 times over by the Federal Reserve. And that's how we hit the $6 trillion-plus figure. And I want to thank our listener, John Zwiebel, who sent me a link to an article in the HuffPost by Zach Carter. And Carter has a book in the pipeline called The Price of Peace, Money, Democracy, and the Life of John Maynard Keynes. And he offers a pretty blistering analysis of the defects of this bill. He quotes Damon Silvers, the deputy chair of the 2009 oversight panel for the bank bailout. If you give vast amounts of public money to a single person with no real accountability, you won't like what happens next. And Carter says, in exchange for this takeover, Democrats got 4 months of more generous unemployment benefits for the millions who will be laid off, a one-time check of $1,200 per adult, eliminating a Republican restriction that would have limited poor people to just $600, and phasing out payments for six-figure incomes. He says these are not bad provisions, but they pale in comparison to the handout offered to the rich. Sarah Miller, executive director of the American Economic Liberties Project, is quoted, "It is a panicked and reckless legislative response. It's one that will repeat most of the mistakes made in the 2008 to 2010 bailouts and fundamentally transform the American economy." Back to the voice of Zach Carter, there is, in fact, an economic emergency right now, just not for the super rich or massive conglomerates. With the Federal Reserve announcing essentially unlimited support for the banking sector and, for the first time, using its authority to directly finance corporate debt. And Boeing CEO David Calhoun said that if his company had to cough up stock in the company, that he'd just go shopping somewhere else. So that is a way of underscoring that while they can project cash shortfalls, they have other options. But they'd rather get free money from the government if they can. And I will point out that this is occurring at a time when we really don't know the scope of their potential losses. And they just throw out a number and Washington says, why, sure. Here's another quote from Zach Carter's piece. The dissonance between the actions of Senate Democrats today and those from just a few months ago is mortifying. In December, House Democrats voted to impeach Trump. And what do they do it for? For withholding congressionally mandated aid to a national ally. Democrats literally tried to remove Trump from office by abusing the public purse for personal political gain. And yesterday, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and every Senate Democrat were preparing to authorize more than $4 trillion for Trump's top lieutenants to pass around. For too long, he says, Democrats have ignored the suffering and dysfunction caused by structural problems with the American economy, trusting that social welfare payments will be sufficient to counter the power disparity between the rich and the rest of us. They are wrong to accept such a bargain now. We live in an era in which the wealthy and the well-connected dominate almost every aspect of our society. The rich not only live different lives than the rest of us, they live significantly longer lives. Quoting again, the financial crisis of 08 and the bank bailouts it inspired did long-term damage to the American social fabric. The financial sector essentially became a criminal syndicate, as fraud settlements became a simple cost of doing business for bailed-out banks like Wells Fargo. The government's unheard-of largesse for wealthy bankers made an infuriating contrast with the unemployment lines and foreclosure signs that became commonplace across the country. We are about to replay this nightmare with a more frightening cast of demons. The small business relief the Senate has agreed to authorize will be too little to stem the tide of failures and arrive too late to help too many firms that will go under. So, I've linked to Zach Carter's piece. You'll find it in the show file at peterbcollins.com, and I encourage you to scrutinize it. Now, I want to thank Mr. Zwiebel. He closed his email by saying there's some portions of this bill that seem to be quote-unquote good, but overall it appears that it is the oligarchy that wins. And yes, I would say by that roughly 6-to-1 margin, we got screwed. Here in California, Governor Newsom has shamed the big banks that write mortgage loans to offer forbearance. He got the lenders who are backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the Federal Housing Administration to agree to forestall evictions of homeowners for at least 60 days and for payment forbearance for up to 12 months. He got Chase Bank to offer a 90-day payment forbearance for mortgage customers nationwide who've been impacted by the virus. Wells Fargo said it will grant an immediate 90-day payment suspension for any home lending customer who asks for it. Well, they've got a little lot of reputational damage to repair, and maybe that explains that apparent generosity. But the tight-fisted people who run Bank of America have agreed so far to only a 30-day payment waiver, and Newsom is asking them to do better. Here's our daily COVID-19 update prepared by Linda Lewis. CDC is reporting 68,000 total cases and 994 total deaths. Media accounts indicate that it's now over 1,000, and that's not surprising. And in the United Kingdom, Gordon Brown, a former prime minister, a Labour prime minister, has urged world leaders to create a temporary form of global government to tackle the twin medical and economic crises caused by the virus. And there has been a conference call G20 meeting that was chaired by the odious king of Saudi Arabia, Salman. And they made a grand announcement that the G20 have pledged a $5 trillion fund to soften the pandemic's blow. But there are no details on who's kicking in how much cash and what the terms of that will be. And often, as we know, as Naomi Klein has schooled us, when disaster capitalism events occur, well, the World Bank enters the picture. And in order to qualify for the loans, nations are required to end practices that are considered socialistic, to end limits on foreign investment and control of their economies, and it spirals down from there. A little bit later, we'll talk about Venezuela, but on the coronavirus front, Linda indicates that the situation appears to be going well in Venezuela, despite the U.S. sanctions and the weak economy there. Often, you know, part and parcel of the U.S. sanctions and the efforts to remove President Maduro. And as we'll report a little later, there's been a dramatic effort by Bill Barr and the Justice Department to up the ante and put even more pressure on Maduro. Here in the United States, we are learning that Ford appears to be accepting the blue sky representations of President Trump. They have tentatively announced that they want to restart truck production in some U.S. factories and one in Mexico by the middle of April. And Trump hosted a private conference call on Tuesday morning with several billionaire Wall Street and hedge fund titans. Yeah, his buddies. And that was just hours before he said he wants to have the country opened up and get people back to work by Easter. So, yeah. That offers you an indication why he's so eager to sign this socialist package. Mostly corporate socialism. Coming out of the Senate and expected to be approved by the House. There is a kerfuffle building between the U.S. and Canada because the ever-aggressive and opportunistic Trump wants to seal the lengthy U.S.-Canadian border by deploying U.S. troops to some of the backwater side roads that connect the U.S. and Canada. Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister who is on self-isolation, is resisting. He said, Canada and the U.S. have the longest unmilitarized border in the world. It is very much in both our interests for it to remain that way. We have been in discussions with the U.S. on this. And the Global News in Canada reports on an extraordinary, unprecedented request from the U.S. I have multiple sources telling me the White House and President Trump want to do this, says a reporter, Mercedes Stevenson. The troops would be there to monitor using military intelligence technology that can pick people up crossing the border. And this is just more of Trump's effort to lock the gates and lift the drawbridge here at Fortress America. Linda also indicates that the Department of Veteran Affairs, which is legally obligated to back up the nation's health care system in this kind of emergency, well, it's headed by a guy with no experience in emergency management, Robert Wilkie. Fortunately, that crazy guy who was Trump's White House doctor, Ronnie Jackson, who he wanted to appoint to run the VA, well, that idea evaporated within hours. And Linda adds here, experience does matter. It takes time to develop a good understanding of the emergency responsibilities of a federal agency, and even more time to become skilled in coordinating emergency response with states and other federal agencies. In New York, Governor Cuomo is confirming there are now 385 deaths statewide, and the hospitals, especially in New York City, are reaching critical capacity limits. And I'll add here that I saw online this morning that some nurses are so desperate for protective gear that they are putting garbage bags, hefty bags, with cutouts for their heads and arms over their upper bodies. That is just so deplorable. And in Texas, the Attorney General's office has intervened to shut down an auction of 750,000 medical-grade masks at a Houston warehouse. In London, meanwhile, the hospitals are besieged by what is described as a tsunami of patients. They're struggling with two things. The first is the explosion of demand. The second is the high rate of illness among healthcare providers. And this is something we're going to have to confront. I've mentioned this, that I'm pleased to see some progress. Washington State, New York State building improvised temporary hospitals, some that will be used for treatment of patients who don't have the virus to take the load off the places where they're already being treated. And in New York, there's been a huge response to a request for volunteers among medical professionals, including psychologists, to volunteer their time to help out at this critical time of need. Total number of cases in New York is more than eight times the number of cases in New Jersey, that has 4,400 cases and 62 deaths. California now at 3,000 cases, 67 deaths. Washington State, 2,500 cases, 130. And I'll mention, too, that the data are a little bit unreliable because we know that testing is now ramping up the reported number of confirmed cases. And BuzzFeed News also reports that the number of deaths may be grossly underreported. And they cite some California ER doctors who say, well, the numbers are grossly underreported. I know for a fact that we've had three deaths in one county where only one has been reported. And there's a whole system for this that state and county officials are supposed to report their data to the CDC. And, of course, in places where they're overwhelmed, they may not be able to do it every day. And so there could be a significant lag. And that's what we have to contend with. China has further tightened travel restrictions as it faces a surge in cases from people returning to their country from overseas, closing its borders even to foreign nationals who live there. And similar to Trump, there's very little warning. The suspension will take effect on Saturday at midnight. The foreign ministry said it's a temporary measure that China is compelled to take in light of the outbreak situation and the practices of other countries. That may be a political response to Trump's continued blaming of China and his claims that, you know, he's the only one who wanted to close the, you know, traffic from China, when in fact, and we'll get that in a minute as we look at fact-checking of some of Trump's recent comments. Yesterday, there was a suspicious event in the town of Belton, Missouri. Timothy Wilson, age 36, was reportedly planning to drive a truck with bombs into a hospital where people are being treated for the coronavirus. But this looks like another FBI setup, because they've issued a statement saying that shots were exchanged with Wilson and he died later at a hospital. Well, what they said is that Wilson was under the close watch of the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, and not just for a week. They claim that he had been scheming for some time. And so they were prepared to arrest him when he tried to pick up what he thought was a bomb, although there was no bomb. Now, this is a pattern of FBI frame-ups that I have criticized for a long time. Tomorrow, I'll be releasing a fresh interview with radical criminologist Tony Platt, and we discuss that issue in a pretty interesting conversation. Well, I'm pleased to report that Gilead, the profiteering drug company based here in the San Francisco area, has declined the honor extended by cronies in the White House, including one of their former lobbyists who is on Jared Kushner's task force. And they are going to reject the offer to declare that remdesivir, which is an unproven antiviral drug, at least in relating to COVID-19 treatment, they are not going to accept the designation under the Orphan Drug Act that would have given them a 7-year exclusive period and essentially the right to set any price they wanted. As I've pointed out in previous coverage of this, U.S. taxpayers invested $79 million in the development of this drug. And fortunately, Gilead has been shamed into rejecting or walking away from that offer. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast. Find folks like Brian Massey, Stuart Russell, Citizens Oversight, That's Ray Lutz and the gang in San Diego, and my friend Suzanne Bowen. I'm grateful to all of you for your support, and I want to renew my message to our subscribers that if you need to suspend your payments because you aren't working and you don't know if you're going to be able to meet the rent or your mortgage in coming weeks, feel free to send me an email or just go to PayPal and suspend your payments. Your subscription will continue. More cruelty from the judge, Vanessa Beretzer, who is the British magistrate who is presiding over the extradition proceedings brought against Julian Assange. She has refused to give him any kind of release from the Belmarsh prison. And as Kevin Gostola reports at Shadowproof, Assange faces imminent danger. He suffers from a chronic lung condition, which makes him especially vulnerable to this virus. An Australian correspondent reported that Beretzer stated, Assange's past conduct shows the lengths he is prepared to go to avoid extradition proceedings. If I released him today, he would not return to face these extradition proceedings. She even suggested that he might commit suicide. The judge has refused to accept an offer of house arrest and an ankle bracelet. And editor-in-chief of WikiLeaks currently, Kristen Hrafnsson, quote, we condemn in the strongest possible terms the decision today not to release Julian Assange on bail. It is unjust and inhumane in light of the crises we are now facing. And as you know, there is a nationwide movement in the United States to end cash bail because of its imbalanced impact on people with limited means. And I want to commend Nick Pinto, a critical thinker who writes for The Intercept. The headline reads, America's crisis daddy, Andrew Cuomo, exploits coronavirus panic to push bail reform rollback in New York. And this is one of the reasons why I have my bias against Andrew Cuomo. I take nothing away from his firm handling of the pandemic in New York State, his demands for greater resources, including tens of thousands of ventilators, his demands for temporary hospital facilities. But he has an authoritarian streak. And over the past year, when he was running for re-election, he allowed a bill to pass into law, which would have provided a commission to investigate and penalize district attorneys who break the law, prosecutor misconduct. After he won re-election, he used his power and influence with the legislature and dramatically rolled back that legislation. So since January, Pinto reports, Cuomo has been pushing for a new law that would roll back the recent bail reforms that went into effect in January and instead expand judges' power to put defendants in jail. Cuomo has backed this agenda for years, but his evident insistence on including it in the state's budget negotiations in the middle of this public health crisis is remarkable. And it's troubling as well. And it is, you know, somewhat contradictory to the image. And I like the term crisis daddy that Pinto has coined. And because the legislature is sheltering at home, they're not meeting, Pinto points out that the budget is pretty opaque, the process in New York. It usually involves the governor and the leaders of the assembly and the state senate. And even some Republicans are saying, look, this is not the right time. If we're going to talk about this, then let's talk about it when everyone's in Albany, when everyone's at the table, said Assemblymember Latrice Walker. She's the one who sponsored last year's bail reforms. These backroom deals just don't make sense. And those of you who are ready to further bend the rules of the Democratic Party's nominating process, I saw a post on Facebook last night, a guy who's saying, look, we know that Bernie's already been cheated again. And while Cuomo is not a very progressive guy, he's a strong leader who would be much better than Joe Biden. And there's a good argument there. But I think we need to understand the full dimensions of Mario's oldest son before we crown him the designated Democratic candidate. Now, I want to commend the Washington Post. They went into overdrive today with three different reports about Trump's antics at these lengthy news conferences that he is holding to preserve his narcissistic supply. And I've given up watching them. I wait for reports to come out. And I agree with people who say that they shouldn't be broadcast live, because you can't fact check him when he dominates the forum and offers blue sky lies and personal attacks. So Aaron Blake said Trump spent 25% of his time at Wednesday's briefing on self-congratulation and placing blame. And he actually did a count. He said that there are about 12 different times. Let me read it here. In all, I counted, not just 12. In all, I counted well more than two dozen instances at Wednesday's briefing in which Trump hailed the success of the coronavirus response or pointed to the obstacles he has faced. These passages constituted about 25% of all the words that Trump spoke, more than 1,500 words out of 6,000. That is more time than he spent conveying details about the coronavirus response. And then the fact-checkers, Glenn Kessler and Salvador Rizzo, at the same Bezos Washington Post, published a 22-page review of his, well, the prevarications and outright lies that have been uttered by the president just this week. And it's the Post that, to its credit, has been keeping track of Trump's public lies. So, for example, Trump always says that he was the only one in the room who wanted to restrict, he says eliminate, travel from China to the United States. But the Post reports that the debate included Alex Azar, the Health and Human Services Secretary, who urged the president to approve the ban. Kellyanne Conway, his stoutest defender with all the alternative facts, she was skeptical. But Trump was not the only person who approved or supported that notion. Then he said, I made a decision to close off China. That was weeks early, and honestly, I took a lot of heat. Sleepy Joe Biden said it's xenophobic. He said it's racist what I did. Well, in fact, that's not what Biden said, and Biden is a sloppy speaker who often embarrasses himself with public statements. But the Post says flatly he did not specifically mention the travel restrictions on China in the comment that Trump was quoting. Let's just pull a couple more. I've linked to this article, and you can peruse it yourselves should you have the time, and I know too many of us have too much time these days. Here's a claim: we had the best economy in the history of our country 3 weeks ago. But he said it more than 250 times. But it was never true. And they go into a statistical analysis to prove that point. And I will stop there with the fact-checking, but you can take a look. Just one more. This came from BuzzFeed. Trump said Democrats and the media want to keep businesses closed to hurt his reelection. Quote, the media would like to see me do poorly in the election. I think there are certain people who would like it not to open so quickly. There are certain people who would like the economy to do poorly because that would be very good as far as defeating me at the polls. I don't know if that's so, but I think there are people in your profession that would like that to happen. I think it's very clear. Then he went on. I think it's very clear that there are people in your profession that write fake news. You do. She does. There are people in your profession that write fake news. They would love to see me for whatever reason, because we've done one hell of a job. Nobody's done the job that we've done, and it's lucky that you have this group right here for this problem, or you wouldn't even have a country left, okay? I mean, these are bizarre ravings by a guy who, as Dr. Justin Frank, the guy who wrote Trump on the Couch in our great interview that I published on Tuesday, was commenting on. Here in California, the embattled sheriff of Los Angeles County, whose name is Alex Villanueva, is using Trump tactics. He's channeling the Donald, because there has been an effort to shift some of his responsibilities because his agency failed badly in response during the Woolsey fire near the end of 2018 that killed three people and burned almost 100,000 acres in L.A. and Ventura counties. And as the efforts continue to remove some disaster response from his agenda and transfer it to the county administrator, well, Alex Villanueva says that this is a pure power grab and it's retaliation because he wanted to close the gun stores as non-essential during the stay-at-home order. Now, there's no indication that that is the case. And I actually support Villanueva for saying that the gun stores are not essential. But he attacked Supervisor Catherine Barger, claiming that she was worried about guns and ammo. Barger said she's never commented on the decision to close gun stores. And she said the Woolsey fire illustrated a need to modernize emergency operations efforts and align with best practices in other jurisdictions. And she's backed up by Sheila Kuehl, who was the child actor on Dobie Gillis, I think. She distinguished herself in Sacramento for years in the state assembly and later as a state senator. And I consider her to be a credible commenter on this struggle for power in Los Angeles County. There is some other news you should know today. In a shocking move in Israel, Benny Gantz, who has twice tangled to take on and defeat Benjamin Netanyahu, his, I wouldn't call him an arch enemy, but an arch opponent, has shocked his own party, which has dissolved apparently in reaction. It's called the Blue and White Party. Benny Gantz has agreed to become the Speaker of the Knesset. And this appears to be part of a deal between Gantz and Bibi to form a unity government as Israel battles the pandemic. We know that under cover of the pandemic response, Netanyahu has closed the courts so that his corruption trial can't continue. He tried to block the majority, the bare majority that Gantz had gathered. And Gantz and his allies were intending to pass bills in the Knesset to block Netanyahu from running for prime minister because he is under indictment. And so Gantz appears to have screwed his own pooch here. Two of the three factions comprising the Blue and White Party have consistently said they will not join a governing coalition or participate in a political scenario that includes Netanyahu. Gantz lost the support of those factions as well as from the wider opposition, including a group of Arab-Israeli parliamentarians who had been willing to back him for prime minister. So this is a troubling development, and we will look for more details in coming days. And as I teased a little bit earlier, the U.S. government, despite the deadly impact of our sanctions on Venezuela and the over-the-top efforts to force regime change in Caracas, now they have added to it at this time when people are prone to get the coronavirus and there's very few resources in Venezuela to deal with any significant caseload. So now they've added insult to that injury by indicting President Nicolas Maduro and accusing him of narco-terrorism and cocaine trafficking conspiracy. In the voice of the New York Times, the indictment of a head of state was highly unusual, served as escalation of the Trump administration's campaign to pressure Maduro to leave office. And Trump's personal attorney and sometime Attorney General Bill Barr announced the charges at a news conference, including the head of the Drug Enforcement administration, and federal prosecutors in Manhattan and Miami. In addition to Maduro, more than a dozen others were charged, including Venezuelan government and intelligence officials. And they say that for years, that Maduro has run a drug-running operation, taking cocaine from the FARC in Colombia, and they claim shipping it to the United States. Now, I will acknowledge that there are lower-level officials who have been accused of this kind of drug trafficking, but I've never seen any evidence to support it. I want to acknowledge that with U.S. sanctions, the crippling low price of oil over the last few years, and it's dropped even further, that it's possible that Maduro and his supporters, his allies in the government, turn to the drug trade to generate badly needed cash. But I don't have any evidence of that. And until I do, I will view this as a provocative setup. And the forgettable State of the Union address that Trump delivered just over a month ago, he called Maduro an illegitimate ruler, a tyrant who brutalizes people, his people, and vowed that Maduro's grip on tyranny will be smashed and broken. And you remember at the end of that speech, Pelosi ripped up the copy of it that she had. But one of the few times that she stood to applaud Trump was when he delivered those lines about regime change in Venezuela. And here's where the New York Times commits yellow journalism. I'm quoting, "The country was hit by the largest economic collapse in its history, a result of falling oil prices and years of economic mismanagement by the left-wing government." Now, they didn't use socialist. It is a socialist government, and it would be fair to do so. But they don't mention anywhere in this coverage the deadly sanctions that have been ratcheted up by the United States. Oh, and they forgot about the effort to remove Hugo Chavez from power in a brief coup attempted by the Bush administration back about 2003. Finally today, earlier this week, I applauded the Secretary General, of the United Nations, Guterres, Antonio Guterres from Portugal, for his call for a worldwide ceasefire. And I lamented the lack of corporate media coverage. Well, there's a report today that offers some analysis and a little bit of a warning about unexpected consequences of such a move. And it's under the byline of a reporter at the United Nations, Samira Sadeka. Conflict experts are concerned that the global ceasefire called for by the UN amid the coronavirus outbreak may not work and could lead to a rise in violence. And then they cite the call by the Secretary General, who called attention to the fact that the most vulnerable women and children, people with disabilities, the marginalized and displaced, pay the highest price in times of armed conflict, combined with a global health crisis. But then they cite the executive director of Armed Conflict Location and the an Event Data Project, who says there are layers to this issue. The ceasefire is a great initiative, and while I certainly hope it works, the data suggests otherwise. I also expect that mob violence and xenophobia will rise. She pointed out that there are some armed groups who are capitalizing on the opportunity, like the Islamic State, hoping to profit from it. There are other indications that some groups will try to deal with this through unorthodox means, like kidnapping doctors. Meanwhile, Amnesty International expressed concern in light of the Secretary General's remarks about the situation in Yemen, South Sudan, and Syria. A ceasefire would, at least to a limited extent, give countries in conflict a little more room to put aggressive efforts into preparing for the potentially devastating impact of the virus. Displaced persons fleeing conflict often live in crowded and unsanitary camps in which social distancing is very difficult, if not impossible, and which clean water may be in short supply. Now, I got to tell you that this insults my bias. Maybe I'm a little idealistic. But to argue that a temporary suspension of conflict, a ceasefire, would be worse than the impacts that they describe here, and I acknowledge that some of these are possible. I don't know. I don't buy it, but I bring it to your attention for your consideration. You'll find a link to this article in the show file at peterbcollins.com. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube, and I'm still Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.